welcome to 251, two pianists, five podcasts, one subject. And in episode four, we're going to be looking at Sonny Clark's trio recordings and digging a bit more into his own personal playing style. My name's Nick Tomlin.
And I'm Simon Whiteside. So our first encounter with Sonny Clark as a trio player is an album that wasn't released until the mid-1990s, but was recorded in 1955 at the Macambo Club, Oakland, California, which is where Hollywood is, basically. And it's a club where the stars would hang out. Lots of people performed there, varying types of acts, comedians, magicians, the usual floor show, but also some people who might be called the more popular end of the jazz spectrum, like Nat King Cole and other singers who were less jazzy, like Lucille Ball and the like, would also perform there. Now, that recording, I think, was probably made on tape because at one of the tracks it sort of slowly fades out, suggesting that the tape, or at least one of the tapes, was about to run out. Tapes last about 20 minutes, generally. You have to be lucky to fall in between two tracks if you're recording something like that. For me, it's quite interesting that he has some feet still in the swing pianist camp, and he's evidently playing quite a lot of bebop material. And he also gets to stretch out a bit on longer periods of improvisation. For example, there's a version of All the Things You Are on there, which he had recorded with Serge Charloff, but he plays many more choruses as a trio player there than he did in the more restrictive studio recording. What are your thoughts, Nick?
Yeah, as you say, it's very interesting that he, on a lot of the tracks, he tends to do these quite Tatum-esque introductions where he'll do this kind of out of time, quite florid sort of introductions, very much in that swing style. But then when he sort of goes into the tune, he's playing bebop. I mean, it's really like Bud Powell influenced bebop. So it's kind of interesting. And he does actually, I mean, these are the two players that he said were his earliest influences, Art Tatum and Bud Powell. So I suppose that in a way that's not surprising that both of those would be in his playing. But I think as he progressed as a player, he kind of dropped that more sort of Art Tatum style. You don't hear it so much, do you, in his later recordings?
And we are now going to go on and talk about those recordings.
In October the 13th, 1957, that was just 1 month after he recorded Sonny's Crib, Sonny Clark went back into the Van Kelder studio in Hackensack and recorded his first trio album for Blue Note Records. And his band for this recording were Paul Chambers on bass, who he'd previously recorded with on Sonny's Crib, and Philly Joe Jones, obviously best known really for his work with Miles Davis. And they recorded a set of mainly standards for this session, and we're going to have a little look at a couple of them. One is the tune Two Bass Hit, and the other is the standard I Didn't Know What Time It Was.
Yes, and that whole set is quite similar in a way to what was recorded at the Macambo Club. There's a mixture of what you might call bebop standards. So they do the tune bebop and they do Tad's Delight and Two Bass Hit, which obviously is a Gillespie tune. But then mixed in with that is I Didn't Know What Time It Was, Softly As In The Morning Sunrise, and I'll Remember April.
Yeah, so as Simon said, Two Bass Hit was first recorded by Dizzy Gillespie All-Stars in 1947. But the version that Sonny Clark does is based more on the Miles Davis recording from 1955. And that recording session, I think, a bit later became the Miles Davis album Circle in the Round. And the arrangement's slightly different on the Miles version. I think originally it was written as a sort of feature for the bass player in the Dizzy Gillespie band, Ray Brown. And it features these little kind of bass interludes. But the Miles version is more of a drum feature, really, and that's how Sonny Clark uses it really on this album, I think.
Is it on Milestones as well, that version? I think there are a few out there.
Yes, yeah.
There are quite a lot of similarities with the original, but I mean, that bass is an obvious difference, but he does seem to follow the format of that original arrangement to a certain degree. And in some respects, Miles deviates more, I think, especially once you get past the head. But there are some sort of shout choruses and things which Johnny Clark seemed to put in. I mean, it's an interesting tune because it's really just a blues, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's a D flat blues. When they get into the blowing, it just goes into a D flat blues. But obviously, the head is quite arranged and it's an interesting arrangement.
And the head's in C, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Which is interesting. Now, Sonny Clark, in his own choices of tunes and his own writing, seems to favour sort of keys like F. So it's quite interesting hearing him blow on D-flat so fluently, because he doesn't seem to play in D-flat that often in out of choice, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And he seems, you know, very strong on that particular solo. I think it does really reflect the difference between his trio playing and his ensemble playing, because he's responsible for the tune, obviously, but he's playing much more with two hands, isn't he, in a way? In the quintet stuff, he's comping with two hands, but when he's soloing, it's almost so right-hand dominated that he's pretty much holding down simple, not very rhythmic, left-hand guides.
Mm.
Whereas in the trio stuff, he's a lot more positive in his comping in the left hand, I think.
Yeah, I think you hear a kind of development. I mean, that's maybe something we'll go on to talk about as we talk about some of the other recordings. But you do hear a change in the way he uses his left hand. And when we get on to talk about the time sessions later, he does actually talk about that. There's an interview where he mentions his left hand and actually consciously working on it. So it is interesting to see how that changes through these recordings.
Yeah. And the other tune we're going to have a little discussion about is I Didn't Know What Time It Was, on this album, and he records this in F, which is not particularly usual. The tune itself is from 1939, written by Richard Rodgers, and lyrics by his common partner, Lorenz Hart, and it was for a musical called Too Many Girls. That was later made into a film, and it was recorded, that was in 1940, it was recorded by, well, it appears to be Lucille Ball, but in fact it's Trudy Irwin who's dubbing her voice for the singing, an RKO picture. So it's been around a little while. And do you know what the original key for this one is, Nick?
I think the original key's in G, although it does. It's one of those tunes which does get played in a few different keys. And I think, it does get played in F, but it's more usual to play in G, I think. So, yeah, so he does... quite a nice little arrangement of this, little head arrangement with some stops. And he uses this little harmonic trick, this kind of descending progression, starting from the flat five chord, descending down, which it's a kind of cliche. People use it very often to end tunes, but here he kind of uses it as a way of ending the head each time. It's quite a nice little device that he uses.
Yeah, the thing I was going to say about that was that it's comes up in almost as the tune in one of the tunes on Birth of the Cool, that use of a single da di do do di do do di do do di do do, that going on, might be called Deception. Anyway, we're going to move on to a much more in-depth analysis of one particular track from the next recordings that Sonny Clark made for Blue Note in trio format.
The next trio recording session took place on November the 16th, 1958, with Jimmy Merritt on bass and Wes Landers on drums. Wes Landers had actually very briefly been a member of the Buddy DeFranco Quartet for about 2 weeks before Bobby White joined that band, so that's obviously how Sonny Clark knew him. And they recorded six tunes this first session, and they were later released as the Art of the Trio album. But what's interesting is they were also released as 45 singles. And it's kind of speculation, but I've always wondered whether Sonny Clark slightly changed his playing style to reflect that. Anyway, I think you know a little bit more about this 45 series of Blue Note, Simon, so I'm going to hand back over to you for a little bit.
Yes. Well, the 45 series is an interesting one because they were, obviously, jukeboxes were a big thing in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And they did have some success. Blue Note had some success with certain tracks, like the Sidewinder particularly. and some of Herbie Hancock's tracks did really well as singles. And there were various options for people to buy music in the 50s. One of them was the LP, which was new, really, and that was the longest format, usually played at 33 revolutions per minute. That you could get about 44 minutes of music on that before the audio quality suffered. But they also released 10-inch records, which one might these days call an EP, an extended play record. They could be played at 33 or at 45, and that obviously gives you different lengths. At 45 RPM, you could fit around 9 to 12 minutes per side. But if you played them at, if they were recorded and reproduced at 33, you could get 12 to 15 minutes per side. So they would normally have three or four tracks on them. But the singles would be one side per track. And generally speaking, at 45 RPM, you're looking at the three-minute pop song, sort of equivalent to the 78 record that Blue Note had been releasing so much in the past. And that all those 78s would have one tune per side. So it was, if you like, the modern version of Blue Note's 78 records. And the pairings were released... Blue Note 45, 17, 31 was Black Velvet and G-Baby. Blue Note 45, 17, 30 was Lucky So-and-So and Ain't No Use. And Blue Note 17, 29 was I Can't Give You Anything But Love and The Breeze and I. And these 45s were very... I think they were a good seller for Blue Note, although they didn't consistently produce the same number of 45s throughout the Blue Note history. Once it was available to them, of course, they didn't produce any to start with. And I think those hit singles did help a lot with their cash flow. And that, and of course, making 45s is slightly cheaper than making 12-inch records in terms of material and album art and size of packaging and all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And of course, the, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that you could have them in a in a jukebox and people could choose to play that, pay to play, as it were, was another option. We need to talk about the next big track that we wanted to discuss, which comes from the next recording session that they did for Blue Note.
Yeah, so December the 7th, there was another recording session. This time, Paul Chambers replaced Jimmy Merritt on bass, but it was still Wes Landers on drums. And my, again, speculation, but I wonder whether these also were intended maybe as 45s, these tracks. But these tracks actually were never released, and they were only released much later in 1979, along with the November session as the album Blues in the Night, where they sort of collected all of these, the trio tracks from these two sessions together. And the track we're going to look at in a bit more detail, Somebody Loves Me, is from the December the 7th session. And yeah, I transcribed the solo and Simon transcribed the head for this tune. So we're going to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting tune, a very good arrangement that he came up with. And we should probably mention what else was recorded that day. So it was Can't We Be Friends, I Cover the Waterfront, Somebody Loves Me that we've just mentioned, Blues in the Night, which obviously gave the eponymous album later, All of You, and Dancing in the Dark. And I think another piece of evidence which might support your theory that they were intended for 45s were they, in general, most of those tunes were pretty popular tunes. Mm. They're not ethereal standards pulled out from some sort of distant memory. Let's get on with talking about Somebody Loves Me. Somebody Loves Me is a George Gershwin tune. It was written in 1924 and featured in George White's Scandals of that year. And those shows were review shows similar to the famous Follies shows that went on. It's a tune that has been recorded by quite a few people, but it's not a very mainstream standard, I would say. Certainly Bud Powell recorded it, and that is a possibility of where Sonny Clark got the idea from, of doing this tune. Although they do play it quite differently, albeit in the same key. He plays it in what you might call a block chord style, but it's not the locked hands block chord style of someone like George Shearing. There's a lot of counterpoint going on in there, and some figures which he puts in to punctuate the main melody. The first point of interest might be the turnaround at the end of the first eight bars. And in this podcast, we've actually recorded a few musical examples to play you. So we're going to play you that now. And this is a fairly typical Sonny Clark turnaround where he goes down in a shape which one could describe as a diminished chord in the left hand. And the line is repeated. There's a little triplet introduction to it, and then he goes down in semitones, rising in tones above that. So, but they're going to do de, do de, do de. And he stresses those second longer notes quite a lot. The second eight then is fairly similar, and he comes into the bridge with what you might call an idiomatic bebop lick. In the bridge, he's got a little bit of a minor sharp five, minor sixth, that sort of pattern going on in the left hand, and a bit of filling in around the phrases. And then he plays this really quite interesting chord in the second half of the bridge, which I wasn't quite... It's a form of a D chord, but it's quite a hard one to work out. And at the end of that bridge, he does another bit of sort of locked hands, little figure up the G minor seven, leading us back to the first chord of F, which is what the key the song's in. And he comes to an end with a little bit of a bluesy lick, linking it. And interestingly, he doesn't play that on the way out, so these are obviously interjections as opposed to planned things sometimes. He picks up into the solo, which is the part of the transcription, Nick, that you did. Although I did discover when I opened my file that I had done half the solo myself, so we doubled up there. Over to you.
So that was the two-bar break into the solo on Somebody Loves Me. Sonny Clark's particularly good at these little breaks into solos. They're quite common, but they're actually quite hard to do well. And I think he sets up the solo really nicely here. It's also quite notable what he's doing with his left hand here. He's playing this kind of... almost like a kind of clave rhythm with his left hand, which is very much associated with Red Garland. And he doesn't really do it very often. He tends to favour the more kind of bebop left hand where you're playing shell voicings. So that's kind of interesting, whether that was, again, because he was thinking more sort of slightly more commercially, that he was thinking this is a 45. I don't know. That's speculation, but it's interesting to note there. So moving on to the next phrase I'd like to look at, which is an example of a kind of longer line. Sonny Clark, he really moved towards these quite long, flowing lines that kind of snake their way through the changes. And this is an example of one of those. Yeah, so these longer lines, they're not particularly unusual. I mean, if you listen to bebop players like Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, they would play quite long lines. But I think Sonny Clark here was really sort of pushing it to, you know, he would play lines that kind of 12 bars, even 16 bars long sometimes. I can hear a little bit of an influence from Lenny Tristano, the West Coast piano player. In fact, Sonny Clark does actually name check him. He talks about his technical ability and conception and how much he admired him. So he was definitely listening to Lenny Tristano. And Lenny Tristano also had this way of playing these very long melodic lines, which kind of sort of snake through the changes. And we've also talked about possible influence on Bill Evans as well, who also kind of favoured these longer melodic lines. And I also just want to talk a little bit about the way he uses rhythmic variety in this phrase, the way he's using rests, the way he uses crotchets, which is quite interesting. So rather than just a kind of stream of quavers, he breaks it up with these little phrases where he's using crotchets, which is quite unusual and really effective in sort of breaking up the rhythm. But what you end up with is this real sense of forward movement and propulsion. And what's interesting, when I was trying to pick these phrases out, it was sometimes very hard to actually figure out where the phrase ends, because he would sort of very, very quickly pick up and move on to the next phrase. So you get this constant sense of forward motion.
Yeah, that's a really great phrase. And it comes in bar 41 of the transcription that we've compiled together. And that's available to our Patreon supporters who are in the £10 and above tier, if you want to have a look at that PDF. So back to you, Nick.
Yeah, so the next extract that I wanted to look at was an example of Sonny Clarke using the blues. He doesn't really use blues vocabulary that much in his playing. We've talked about this before, especially when he's playing a standard. But this is an example of him kind of using it. And it's quite nice. What he does, he takes a little bar phrase and then he just repeats it. But it works quite nicely because the chords are changing. So although the phrase is repeating, the chords underneath are changing. And he uses this kind of little blues ornament. So he's kind of using the flattened third and the flattened fifth to ornament the line, which is quite nice. And then in the last bar, he does actually use the blues scale. He plays a little bluesy kind of phrase and then sort of gets out of it back into the solo. So should we have a listen to that?
Yeah, I mean, I do like the blues inflections that Sonny Clarke brings, and I think the fact that he uses them sparingly makes them all the more powerful. Now, the next phrase that you wanted to talk about was something which I think ties back nicely into the longer lines, because it's the way in which Sonny Clarke can use motives within lines to sort of link them up and make them longer. Why don't we listen to that phrase now?
Is a phrase starting around bar 103 in the transcription that we've put up on Patreon. And as Simon said, this is a really good example of the way that Sonny Clarke would sometimes use the end of a phrase as the starting point for his next phrase. And this was a way of kind of elongating the line and sort of keeping things flowing. And that's how he ends up with this real sense of momentum and flow in his solos. So in this specific example, what he's doing, he ends the phrase with a major third, descending major third, so he's going from A to F. And then he starts his next phrase with those same notes, A and F, but he's kind of changes the rhythm, he sort of syncopates them, and then he uses that interval as the starting point, and he sort of builds the next section of his solo. And in fact, he kind of refers back to that interval. So for example, in bar 109, he plays this descending arpeggio and he ends with, again, a descending major third. So for me, this kind of shows that he's thinking motivically and intervallically when he's improvising, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, I find that very interesting also. And I think it's something I've really picked up on the later period of Sonny Clarke's playing, this ability to link things together and refer back to them and have more of a cogent sort of set of ideas within a solo, making each solo something in itself, almost compositionally. Now, the head out is almost identical, and I say that advisedly, is that a lot of the same elements are there and some are different. So first thing that is exactly the same is there's a little lick that he does after the first phrase of the tune, which is sort of doo-ba-doo-ba. And in 1957, Louis Prima had a really big hit with Pennies from Heaven, and they use that phrase in that. I don't think it's uncommon, but I wondered, as this is after that, whether that had some sort of sonic reference. The ba-da-ba-da-doo-dee-doo-da-doo-da phrase is exactly the same as it was last time. But some of the little bluesy interjections he does, he, instead of having a D on the top, he might have a C on the top or an A on the top and a B on the top, whatever. So those are maybe slightly more improvised. And he has this descending phrase, which in the first head he plays in sort of locked hands. In this one, he punctuates the descending line with chords in the right hand while playing the line in the left hand. And then we come to the coda, which our listeners will be familiar with, because this is the music we've been using to introduce, finish, and link the show. So we have this rising fifth figure over a pedal bass, and a sort of what you might call four, that tune four, Miles Davis, da do da, da do da, da do da, da do da, that sort of feel, leading us into a nice little run. And you're going to hear that nice little run now.
The next trio session Sonny Clarke was involved in was in 1960, March the 23rd. So it was a bit of a gap from his previous recording session. And this was recorded for the Time record label rather than Blue Note. Most of his previous sessions have been with Blue Note, but this was with the Time record label. It was recorded in Bell Studios in New York. And the personnel for this session were Max Roach on drums, George Duvivier on bass, and obviously Sonny Clarke on piano. And there's some really nice liner notes, again, on this album, with some direct quotes from Sonny Clarke. And he actually talks about the other musicians on this album, so it's worth looking at that. He says, "This rhythm section has had so much experience that they're immediately able to get down to what you want to do." And then talking about Duvivier, he says, "He has a really good beat, a big sound, and his notes are always choice. Max, aside from his ability to swing, always plays so cleanly. He helps to make a trio full. These are two dream cats for a pianist." So, you know, he obviously really respected these players, and again, the fact that they obviously had worked together before meant that he could kind of slot in, and it all kind of worked well. As I mentioned before, this session was recorded for the Time record label. And I'm going to hand over to Simon, who's done a little bit more research about this record label.
Yes, this is a record label run by a chap called Bob Shadd, who had quite a long career in the music industry, recording all different types of music, but he did record quite a lot of jazz. He was at Mercury Records, setting up the Emercy label there, and he had two, in fact probably three, jazz labels. Certainly Time Records and Mainstream Records are jazz, but he also had a label called Brent Records. I'm not sure if that was so much a jazz sort of format, or whether he had rhythm and blues and other sorts of artists recording for him. And it seems that Sonny Clarke was with them really for 1960, and he recorded a few albums with them, the trio album and the Benny Green sextet album, and they were well recorded. The only problem I have is the quality of the piano isn't great, I don't think, on that recording. It's a bit jangly, a bit out of tune. And also, although Sonny Clarke is more free, he's less accurate in my opinion in his playing on this album. They recorded quite a lot of the same tunes that he recorded for My Conception, which didn't get released at this time, from Blue Note, which he recorded in late 59. The tunes on this album are in the order they were recorded: Minor Meeting, Nika, Sonny's Crib, which is mistitled as Sonny's Crib on the, which is another tune by him, which makes things a little bit difficult. Blues Mambo, Blues Blue, Junker, My Conception, and Sonia. So it's quite a big crossover with the My Conception album, which has two versions of Minor Meeting. I think it's got Blues Mambo, Blues Blue, Junker, and My Conception on it as well. I don't think it has Sonia on it, does it?
No.
So that's the that's the tunes that they recorded. And there is a version. We've been putting up playlists for people to get some of this stuff into their ears beforehand if they wish to, or refer back to afterwards. On Apple Music and possibly others like Amazon, you can get the entire Time recordings where you get lots of different versions. They recorded at least three takes of Minor Meeting, but not all of them obviously made the album. The tune Sonia, which we'll talk about first, is a C major, nice sort of happy tune, and he does stretch out on quite a long solo on this. What are your thoughts on that, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice tune, interesting kind of original. Yeah, he plays quite a long solo, and then they go into this section where he's kind of alternating four. So he plays four bars, and then the bass plays four, and then he plays four, and then the drums play four bars. So kind of swapping fours before heading back into the tune. But it's a great tune. It's a really nice tune. Yeah.
Well, the tune we're going to focus on is Minor Meeting, and that's because it's the tune of his own originals that he recorded the most. And the actual version that I preferred, and it gave me a lot of the things I wanted to talk about, his soloing style, gave me a lot of opportunities to get them in one solo, was the Take 9 version of that. And we'll listen to that now. So that was my trio rendering of the first chorus of Take 9 from the Time albums, recorded in 1960, as we've said. And obviously it's not Sonny Clark playing, that's me playing on top of me playing the bass sample. But it does give me quite a lot of phrases which I wanted to talk about in Sonny Clark's style, which I picked up from all the different types of recordings that we've been listening to over these podcasts. First of all, he likes to use enclosure. An enclosure is something where you approach a note from the notes that are very close to it. The very first phrase here in this, the opening phrase of this particular solo, which is another break, he is really trying to start from a C, but he goes to D, E flat, then B, then back to D, and then to C and up the scale. And that's quite a typical Sonny Clarkism, and also many other bebop pianists. It's quite a common style. But then we have these drops of a fifth, which Nick mentioned about a solo on Moon River a while back when he was playing with Grant Green. And he seems to be using that quite a lot in this solo. That comes in bar three, for example. The other thing I really like about Sonny Clark's playing is his use of minor chords. And this has got some, obviously the tune is called Minor Meeting and we're in C minor here. And he goes back to the sixth note of the scale quite a lot. So that's an A. And there's a good example of that in bar seven. And he often, in this solo, does go back to an A. Happens again in bar 10, for example. Now, the really interesting thing, we were talking about the longer lines, and sometimes it's we're talking about how he links things together. But obviously, like all jazz players, and to this day as well, he has learnt some licks and obviously had some input to his playing from other players by taking things down from records. And there's one very significant one. The bridge on this particular version is almost identical to something he plays in his solo on the My Conception album on the version that is in C minor, which is the one with Kenny Burrell on guitar. and I think it's Clifford Jordan on sax. And they are almost note for note. So, Nick, I think you pointed out that you thought some of that might have come from a Charlie Parker lick.
Yeah, when I heard that phrase, it just reminded me of a Charlie Parker lick, which he uses a lot. He tends to play it as a double time lick. In fact, I had a quick look through the Omni book, and I found it in a couple of solos. He does it in Steeplechase as a double time lick, and so I think Sonny Clarke has probably picked it up from there, I would imagine.
Yes, the Charlie Parker Omni book, for those of you who don't know, is one of the mammoth transcription books that many jazz musicians refer to, and there are even E flat and B flat editions, and obviously concert pitch editions, which you can get. And that links in nicely with my next point, really, because I think that one of his other licks that he links back to saxophone players is what I've called his, in inverted commas, sax lick. It's a way in which he joins notes together, but uses fundamentally almost like slurs, like glissandos. And there are two really good examples of this in this solo. The really big one is near the end, bar 29 of the transcription on Patreon. He slightly displaces the rhythm and goes and you hear Dexter Gordon, for example, who Sonny Clarke played with, as we know. That's a real classic, almost Dexter Gordonism. I'd like to talk also about the various different versions of Minor Meeting, because he recorded a lot of them. And in fact, the first one was on an album called Tenor Man, which was recorded on the West Coast. And it was actually a Lawrence Murrable album with a tenor player called James Clay on it.
Yes, and going back to the liner notes that I mentioned earlier, he talks a little bit about his time on the West Coast. So I thought it might be good to just look at this quote from him. It's quite a long quote, but it's worth reading in full because it is quite revealing, I think. So he says, when I was out on the coast, I didn't feel like I was going anywhere. Now that I've come back home, I've been getting more and more into the groove here. There are more pianists in the East, and in general, there's so much greater a variety of musicians to hear. You can't get hung up just on one vein of thought. Now that I'm used to New York, I've returned to the original way that I wanted to play, more freedom to think and more spontaneity in all areas. You have to be open and free to be able to play in the East, if you have any ears at all. There's so much going on around you. You hear Bud, Monk, Tommy Flanagan, Red Garland. They all play differently, and that encourages you to play differently. So I think that's an interesting insight, really, into, well, A, his he somehow felt more at home back in New York. He refers to it as home, which is interesting, even though he wasn't actually born there. And that maybe his time on the West Coast had a bit of trouble fitting in. And in fact, I think you actually mentioned this, Simon, you know, I think he talks about it elsewhere as well, that he found he had to kind of find a way to play with the players on the West Coast, whereas somehow in New York he felt more at home. And interesting that he also mentions other players like Tommy Flanagan, Red Garland. So he was obviously listening to these players as well.
Well, I think the thing that he spoke about being in the Lighthouse All-Stars and the players that he found easiest to sort of get his tips from and work with were the people who had East Coast experience, like, say, Stan Levy, Conti Candoli, those sorts of people. I think his time in the Buddy DeFranco band was really important to him, but I think he was very much told what to do. My feeling is that this is how I want my piano player to play, if you know what I mean. I don't mean he was being told what to play. I mean just the parameters under which a Buddy DeFranco outfit should work.
Mm.
And I think, you know, same for the bass and drums. They're very straightforward in the way they play. There's very few bass solos or drum solos on any of those albums.
Mm.
So I think the freedom thing comes from that partly too, that idea that in New York he's his kind of own man doing what he wants to do.
Mm.
And, you know, he does talk about his references, how much he liked Bud Powell and people like that.
Yeah.
And I think also we did say that perhaps on the West Coast it's a lot harder to be, you know, that everything's more spaced out. You're not on top of each other really, and all the clubs were in different places, even quite, you know, sort of tens of miles apart, as opposed to 52nd Street where they're yards apart, and you might have a more of a community sort of feeling. I mean, maybe it's worth reading out that quote from about his influences from the Time album.
Yeah, so he's talking about Bud Powell. So he says, I heard Bud while I was still in school, and at that time I was also impressed by several boogie-woogie pianists because of their left hands. There was also Fats Waller and, of course, Art Tatum. Both of these pianists, too, were very strong two-handed players. And in the past couple of years, I've been trying to develop my own left hand so that the music will sound fuller. So again, it's interesting that he's really thinking about his own development as a player. You know, I think some players kind of find their style early and then they kind of just play in that same way throughout their career. But I feel that Sonny Clark, although he had a very short life and career, unfortunately, I feel that he was definitely one of those players that was looking to expand as a player and looking to improve and develop. That's the sense I get anyway from that particular quote.
Well, let's have a very quick comparison of the different versions of Minor Meeting, and then to wrap up this episode, we'll have a more general discussion about his stylistic points in improvisation and to a certain extent in tune writing. So I've got a little spreadsheet I made here with the differences. So the version on Tenor Man, that's in C minor. It starts with a almost Latin-y drum solo, and it finishes with a fade on that descending chord figure. That was recorded at the Capitol Tower Studios. Now, the next version that we hear is from the Cliff Jordan, Kenny Burrell version that was recorded in 1957, so very soon after he arrived back, you know, as he says, back in New York. Again in C minor, but it's got obviously horns on it and a guitar, one horn and a guitar. And the difference between this one and the previous one is that there's a kind of diminished descending thing, da da da, that thing. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of a tag. And in the first version, James Clay just blows over that and lets Sonny Clark play the pattern underneath. But on this one, they repeat that tag to get back into the tune, which is the only version that happens, the one with Kenny Burrell. And they finish with the main theme, but stop on an end chord, whereas the Tenor Man version is a fade on the descending sort of bum 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 diddle diddle dum ding ding ding, and that slowly fades out. Mm-hmm. But strangely, on my conception, there's the other version, which has got Donald Byrd and Hank Mobley on as a quintet version, and they do that in G minor, and I'm not 100% certain why why they do that in a different key, unless it's something to do with like making it fit nicely for trumpet.
Mm.
It still starts with a drum solo. That's Art Blakey. And all three versions up to now have started with a drum solo, but they end very differently. They use that diminished tag thing I've just been talking about, and they finish on that. So that's kind of an unresolved end, if you like. And then finally, the versions, the three or so versions that are on the Time album, the trio, they've dispensed with that. And it's interesting because Max Roach was really known for those sorts of feels, wasn't he, as well, which is quite weird.
Mm-hmm.
But they dispense with the drum introduction. They just start straight in.
Mm-hmm.
And on the coda, they end with the main lick, but instead of ending on what you might think of as the tonic chord, they end on a not tonic chord. So it leaves it unresolved, and it sort of hangs there a bit. The only thing I would say is that on this particular album, Sonny, there's two at faster speed and one at Take 9-1 was at a slightly slower speed, and he plays the tune a lot more crisply there, but it's quite a hard tune to play all of it, if you like, in trio version. The horns, when he was playing it with the horns, he wasn't obviously playing the main lick, so but a little ching ching ching, he's playing the stabs, if you like, and he does get his fingers in a bit of a twist on at the very faster speed, but they are fast. We're talking sort of 280 type up to, heading towards 300 type speeds. Is there anything you've thought about the differences, or have I covered them all?
No, I think you've covered it really. But I agree. It's very interesting to look at the different versions and see how, you know, every time he came to record the tune, obviously depending on the personnel and depending on the situation, he's just rethinking it slightly, isn't he? And I suppose also maybe other musicians were coming up with ideas as well. I mean, that very often happens, doesn't it? You know, but it's very interesting to hear the different versions, like you say, and compare them.
I was talking to our mutual bass playing friend Dominic Howells about this the other day when he discussed the idea that the Speak Low arrangement on the album with John Coltrane was, whether it was actually, could you call it an arrangement, or was it something that they'd rehearsed? Obviously the Blue Note recording situation allowed for sometimes 2 days, but definitely 1 day of rehearsal before a recording. So it could just be people coming up with ideas in those rehearsals and sort of notating them down loosely or whatever, or, you know, perhaps it was written down. It's very difficult to know for sure. In our final little section, we're going to have a think about some stylistic points other than the ones that we've already picked up. Yep, so to sum up, compositionally, Sonny Clark's written a lot of tunes which have repeated phrases with reharmonization. That's something I've taken away from all this study that we've been doing. He often finishes with a cycle of fifths, sometimes going away from where he wants to be to end on a different chord, or sometimes starting away and coming back to where he wants to be. I think also a lot of his tunes, particularly the later tunes, and really on Leapin' and Lopin', you hear them a lot. He's starting to get the association with Monk, for me, is starting to come through. And he's getting some more angular lines in there and some slightly more dissonant notes. But in general, I think compositionally and improvisationally, he stays inside, as we would say as jazz players, he stays inside the chords. He doesn't impose like an E major onto an F chord. The only time he does that is when he sometimes finishes the end of a solo with the chord, a semitone above, resolving multiple times. Here's an example of that now. As we've said before, I don't think Sonny Clark is an originator necessarily in bebop language, but he has honed the bebop language. And I find, for want of a better word, I find his soloing very meaty, that there's a lot of content in there. Whereas some people are, in a way, getting their kicks from pyrotechnics and very fast playing and very technically difficult playing. I think Sonny Clark is a much more simple player, but because of that, the content needs to be rich in order for you to get that material out.
Yeah, no, I agree. He's very tasteful. You know, he never does anything, like you say, you never feel that he's doing something just because it's something that he's learnt and he's kind of showing it off. It always has a kind of context, doesn't it, and a meaning within the improvisation, or, you know.
Yeah. I mean, one little signature type idea that seems to crop up quite a lot, and again, I don't think it's necessarily 100% original, it's idiomatically within the style, is his approach to coming into a minor chord. There's one example from Lulu, which I'll play now. And there's another example here from the beginning, his very first phrase. It actually starts the entire tune of his version of Softly as in the Morning Sunrise. And in fact, at one point I compared this version, his version, with the version that Winter Kelly did. That's quite an edifying thing to do. And finally, I had a little phrase which I think backs up your motivic invention and linking ideas. This is from a solo I took down, one of the first solo I ever took down of Sonny Clark was on the Serge Charloff Blue Serge album, on his version of All the Things You Are. He finishes at the end of the first phrase and then mimics himself, as it were. And in fact, that entire solo, you can hear this little dropping phrase all the way through. So here's that now. And in general, I think Sonny Clark's a very fluid player. I like the simplicity of his lines. I mean, his touch and his articulation are very compelling, aren't they? Rhythmically compelling.
Yeah, there's a sort of a lightness and a bounce which really comes through, I think, especially in comparison with other pianists around. Obviously, every piano player has their own particular touch, their own particular feel, but I always get that sense of, for want of a better word, bounciness with Sonny Clark. It's kind of light, bouncy, and
yes,
it's very unique. You can't really mistake it.
No, and I wonder whether that is a combination of his, you know, West Coast experience and East Coast experience. Not all players played on both coasts, so you get some people who are definitely West Coasters and other people who are East Coasters. And the people who straddled both, I think, probably have a richer viewpoint, if you like. So we're going to wrap up now. We've been talking about Sonny's style as a leader in the trio environment and his soloing style with a few musical examples. I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters who are giving us a small amount of money each month to help with all our costs in making the podcast and eventually the costs for clearances and things, so we'd better use more real music examples, for example, in the book that we're going to put together of what we've learnt about Sonny Clark's playing and his life. So, from me, Simon Whiteside, goodbye.
And from me, Nick Tomlin, goodbye.